In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We explore how research in state universities folds into and holds up economic growth in South Dakota. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, August 12th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, an in-depth conversation with SDSU President Barry Dunn and business leader Mark Lukey. We'll look at the land-grant university's efforts to achieve R1 status. Think of it like Division I, only for science. And we'll ask how money is spent, how it benefits South Dakota, and what's happening with federal funding. Plus, today's Teacher Talk looks at cell phones in the classroom. A blanket ban on the devices might not be as straightforward as policymakers would like. We'll ask what's at stake and what we're asking teachers to do when we scuttle the small screens. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota is one of five states without an R1 university. South Dakota State University hopes to change that. An R1 classification is the highest research designation a school can receive through the Carnegie classification system. We'll learn more about that classification, its requirements, and its economic impacts now. Barry Dunn is president of South Dakota State University. Mark Lukey is managing director and CEO of South Dakota Innovation Partners. They join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
We had at our very origin a research mission at SDSU as a land-grant university, and research universities across the United States, there's about 4,000 universities and colleges, and they are ranked a lot like athletic conferences or teams or schools. And so there's Research One, Carnegie status universities, and they're the top research institutions in the United States, and there's 130 of them or so, very many. And then there's Research Two universities, which is a scale lower, less, and it's all a measurement of two criteria now, the dollars of research expenditures each year and the number of PhD students you graduate. And so we're a Research Two university, and we aspire to be a Research One institution.
And from an economic development standpoint, that's our local engine. And when you look at the competitive landscape in terms of research universities in the region, North Dakota State, University of North Dakota, Minnesota, the two universities in Iowa, there are a number of other R1 research universities in the area. And so as President Dunn alluded to, like athletics, being D1 has done a lot of things for our university, the cities, the state, and so having an R1 designation is really just a rallying cry around President Dunn's vision. So it gives us something to strive for.
Is that almost all focused on sort of science, technology, research, or is there an arts element to research? Is that some other area of the university?
It's research and creative activity, but it would be research, but not just in the hard sciences. It includes research activity in social sciences, too.
Okay.
And one of the things that we did to march towards R1 was we asked for and received permission from the Board of Regents to offer a PhD in social sciences just this last spring. That's a huge step forward for us. We've never had that opportunity before. So in the arts and in the social sciences, like sociology and psychology, history, we can now, those faculty now become players in this puzzle that we're trying to put together to increase research productivity. It's a really great all-around thing for the university.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned, Mark, it's a local engine for economic development. Let's talk about why that is. Convince me how those two are connected.
Absolutely, Lori. It's if you think about how we start new companies from university research or the process of research commercialization, the technical definition is technology transfer. And so it's all really a numbers game when you think about it. The more research expenditures that a university has usually leads to more invention disclosure forms from professors. And that's really when professors are writing down on a piece of paper, hey, I've got an idea, and I might have a little bit of early data from a grant that I was awarded. And that invention disclosure form then gets evaluated for whether or not it should be patented. And that's how universities develop patents. And then once something is in a patent, you know, it's a tangible form. It's an asset that the South Dakota Board of Regents owns. And that can be licensed to existing companies or it can be licensed to startup companies. And when you think about how we've started our businesses from South Dakota Innovation Partners, two in particular, HUDEC and MedGene, those both came from South Dakota State Research. And they both started on a piece of paper as an invention disclosure form. So two perfect examples of how we can turn university research, if it's funded appropriately, both at the federal and the state level, into local economic development.
So the people who are doing the work, do they benefit from the patent in some way?
Of course. Yeah. So typically, the people that are doing the work, the professors, in one way, because they're employees of the state university system, there's a process and a policy set in place by the Board of Regents where they receive some of the compensation that the university receives in the form of royalty payments and different licensing fees from the company. Some of that goes back to the professor, because just like any organization, you have to have the incentive there for the employee to want to do this type of work. And then typically what happens is the company, for example, our companies, will either sponsor research at the university, and so we might buy some time of the professors so that they can spend some time in the company, or the professor does have some time that they can operate as a consultant. So the professor is absolutely incented to help, you know, stimulate this economic development activity.
Yeah. President Dunn, what's in it for the students who might be part of a research project at SDSU?
Right. Well, it's having gone through the ladder of degrees from a bachelor's degree to a master's degree to a PhD in research, it's extremely difficult. It's very challenging. It's very exciting. So for them, it is really the gateway to a future, either at a university or in a large company that's conducting research around the specialization that the student has chosen. It really does start at SDSU with undergraduate research. This is many years ago now, but when I was a student, I did two undergraduate research projects, and I just loved it. And it really did turn me on to want to stay and get a master's degree. And that master's degree was probably, other than marrying my wife, probably the best decision I ever made, because the master's degree opened so many doors for me. Mm-hmm. And it does that for all students. So it's that research experience is novel. It's kind of unique. And it's also extremely exciting as a young person to review the literature, understand a problem at its or challenge at its very core, and then come up with some trial and error about how that challenge could be met or developed or explored further. Yeah. It's really fun.
And if I could add to that, Lori, President Dunn said it exactly right. And in even further, you know, students that are doing research at the university tend to be very good employee candidates for companies that are getting formed. Most of our students don't want to leave the area. A lot of them are forced to because there just aren't, you know, jobs that they're highly interested in. But if they've done research at the university and they know that there's an opportunity to do similar type of research at a local company that perhaps is licensed technology from the university, if you just think about our two operating companies, HUDEC and MedGene, we have over 200 employees. Many of them are South Dakota State students. So not only is it good for the student doing research, but it's great for the company trying to do workforce development.
Yeah. Okay. Spin out one of these examples. Tell me about MedGene.
MedGene is a USDA-licensed veterinary vaccine manufacturer, and we've taken advantage of some new regulations that the USDA has put out for licensing veterinary vaccines. They're called platform technology guidelines. And what that allows us to do is, once we have the platform technology fully licensed by the USDA, which we have several, we're able to change the vaccine while the virus is changing. and we don't have to go all the way back through the process for new regulatory approval. So a great example of that, Lori, is H5N1, or avian influenza, which has hit dairy cattle in South Dakota. Because of our platform technology, we had a vaccine ready right at the outbreak of H5N1 in dairy cattle. Now, the USDA has asked us to do some additional studies, and we've done all of those studies. We expect our conditional license very soon, but it's an application where SDSU Research started a company, we built a platform that was licensed by the USDA, and now we're helping South Dakota cattle producers. So it's really remarkable.
I don't understand what a platform is for a vaccine.
So platform is one where you can make a vaccine with a technology that doesn't change. It's you're basically inserting certain genetic material into cells that are expressing protein, and that protein becomes the vaccine. But you're able to insert different genetic material into that platform freely.
Okay. So the implications or applications for that in the future could be beyond H5N1?
Yes. In fact, another good
example. Or just the changes of that virus.
No. One of the things that's really cool and not so cool for the cattle producers, because right, this has them very nervous, New World screwworm. So right now, it has the USDA's top attention in terms of threats to the U.S. cattle herd. And it's a parasite that's happening down in southern Mexico and Panama, really where it's endemic, mm-hmm. but it's moving northward. And Texas in particular, the cattle producers are very, very nervous because it's devastating. It typically wipes out cattle herds. Well, Medgene, with its platform technology, using the same technology we've developed a tick vaccine for, we've developed a vaccine for New World screwworm. And so, again, we're working very closely with the USDA to actually test the vaccine in southern Mexico so that we can stop the northward spread of New World screwworm into the United States.
Interesting. You were nodding your head. I want to make sure you didn't have anything to add to that.
The platform is it's the best and most creative approach for all of us. all of us in the animal world I think it's great news because viruses mutate all the time, as we know with the flu vaccine that we get every year and is only partially effective because it's always changing. Well, this technology allows the company to respond within weeks of that variation virus mutates and changes, then the vaccine can be changed just very dramatically and very quickly and very effectively. And there's nothing else like it. Because the current technology for vaccines, even the mRNA vaccines, which are very, very good, but that takes a long time actually versus the platform technology. It takes a long time to change and get that dose out to either a public or to an agricultural enterprise that's experiencing this dynamic situation. Mm-hmm. So it's really
mRNA
amazing.
Is not a platform. It's different than that.
It's different than mRNA. Okay. Yeah, okay. Because as you know, Lori, there's many states and even now at the federal level, there's a lot of controversy around mRNA. Even some producer groups have some concerns about it. This is not an mRNA platform.
Okay. Yep. I want to go back to the areas of focus, President Dunn, of the research. Do you have priorities that you're trying to fund?
Right. The three priorities that we're working on are the first is around the data and the technology around precision agriculture, and that's going to be applied not only to agronomic crops, but also to livestock production. And so that's our first one. The second one is in rural health and medicine. We are one of the most rural states. And for example, we are considered a desert for OBGYN care for women. And so we need to work on solutions to rural health problems. And the third one is in bioprocessing and in bioproducts. The state of South Dakota is rich in the grains and and also the co-products like stover or but corn, wheat, soybeans, sunflowers, and all of their stalks and stems and all of that material can we can add value to it by processing it further like ethanol, but kind of if you take the a couple steps beyond ethanol, we can create very, very high value products. We have research going on using a bioprocess to create organic dyes for food that would you know, is in the news a lot about their
organic dyes for food.
Yeah,
versus,
organic, natural, you know, that degrade over time. And
sure.
And so everything from that to improving the processing for soybean meal that HODEC does so well and increasing its value in the food chain. So it's just the, you know, developing plastics from organic oils that degrade in a fraction of the time of petroleum-based products. I mean, the sky's the limit on actually all three of those initiatives.
So these are competitive grants to get. What makes a great grant proposal?
Well, I'll start, but Mark's does a lot of grants too. So it meets the requirements that the granting agency has set up, and for time, for the efficient use of the all the money that's coming, mm-hmm. And then there's an awful lot of accounting that needs to be done. So you have to have a good reputation that your university is a trusted. Trusted research agency, and so we have that now, and we've been very successful. We the last fiscal year we had over $94 million worth of grant expenditures, which is 18% higher than last year's and the highest we've ever reached. Yeah. So we're very successful right now, and we're on our way.
Yeah. What would you add to what makes a great grant proposal?
Well, President Dunn really nailed it, and congratulations to South Dakota State University on $94 million, because it's fantastic. And it's important to note that metric there is above what's required for an R1. So it's really down to getting the PhD students through the system. So it's within our grasp to reach the R1 goal. I think one of the other important things for certain grant proposals is matching funds and good funding partners or good financial partners that are part of that process. And Lori, I'll go back to really the research origins of both HODEC and MedGene. These were started out of 2010 research centers that were funded by then Governor Rounds during his administration. And those 2010 research centers provided just a little bit of state funding for university research. And in many cases, it was collaborations between USD and SDSU or the School of Mines. They would come together and form, you know, a virtual research center. And then when you had a little bit of state funding, you could leverage that to go out and get bigger federal funding. And to be able to leverage those dollars one time, and then from a private company's perspective, to go leverage that again, you know, to say, okay, we had a little bit of state funding that allowed us to get a little bit more federal funding. A company licensed it, and then they brought a lot of private capital to the table to take the research into job creation. Mm. That sometimes that's really important to get these grants funded. So, if South Dakota wants, you know, outside money, federal money, other type of private capital to come into the state, we need some help from a seeding standpoint. That has to be seeded, and it's typically seeded by the state governments. We're seeing a lot of state governments around the country step up at a time when the federal government is actually funding less research.
Right. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the finances a little bit. Opportunities and challenges, some recent challenges, President Dunn.
Certainly, we're in a very competitive world right now, and a world that's dynamic and changing in its appreciation for and maybe investment in research that improves our lives. And so there were certainly some messages from the federal government over the last 6 or 7 months that have been quite dramatic. But all in all, right now, we're hopeful. The Senate Appropriations Committee has an appropriations bill ready to be voted on that's actually quite friendly to research. And some of the changes that people might have read about regarding the the extravagant, it's called FNA, facilities and administrative costs that some universities have had. We've never been at those levels, but actually I think it's going to be a good thing that discussion is now front and center, and there's some really creative ideas about having facilities and administrative costs more balanced for small universities like ours versus just the big schools. So, you know, it's a very dynamic time. It's easy to get kind of worked up about things, but if you just kind of swallow hard and stay patient, it looks like things might work out in some ways to make us more competitive.
Right. So the headlines of an $86 million grant loss, put that in perspective for us then. Is that a fair headline?
Yeah, that grant was canceled. We had the opportunity though to reapply for it. We had to make some dramatic changes, and that grant is being reevaluated right now by the
what changes?
The level of participation of the it was really a demonstration project as much as it was a research grant. So we needed to increase the level of participation by actual farmers and ranchers and decrease some of the research part of it. And we made those changes, and now it's being reevaluated.
Okay.
So, you know, we're hopeful that it gets funded. If not, there's new grant opportunities that have been announced by USDA, NSF funding, and NIH funding, all of these acronyms that mean a lot to me, but National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation. There's new grant opportunities all the time, and our team is working hard to apply for new grants all the time.
Yeah.
And so,
Mark, you mentioned state government. Mm-hmm. Also tough budget year for state government.
It is.
And getting tougher.
Yes.
Lots of people are coming saying this is the most important thing. Help
yes.
me understand what the state budget forecast looks like for funding for research at SDSU.
Well, we're meeting with as many people as we possibly can, actually providing tours of the facilities that we've created over the last 10 to 15 years, and really trying to help them understand the research commercialization process. I think that's maybe one of the most important activities that we can do, is to really just demonstrate, if you fund here, this is what it means to state economic development. And it's just wonderful to have the partnership that we have with South Dakota State University, and to have two real life examples where you can see job creation and tax revenue and things that really came out of an original state funding of university research.
Yeah. Tell me about HUDEC.
HUDEC is fermenting soybean meal, and that's important right now because the price of soybean meal is down significantly, and it's primarily because there was a significant amount of crush capacity that was built out across the United States, including here in South Dakota. South Dakota Soybean Processors has a very successful project that they're, cutting the ribbon on either this week or next week in Mitchell, South Dakota. And so what we do is we buy soybean meal, just like a poultry producer or a pork producer would do, and then we ferment that soybean meal. And in that process, we're removing a lot of the sugars, which are really hard for animals to digest, mm-hmm. and we're increasing the protein content such that it's an important ingredient now globally for aquaculture. And Atlantic salmon in Norway in particular. Mm-hmm. And so it's very easy for them to digest. It's a very high quality protein in their feed formulas now. And we're beginning to move into dog and cat food because we're starting to see some benefits in the microbiome of a pet, of a dog or a cat. And so it's very exciting. It's very exciting for soybean farmers here in South Dakota because it's a unique opportunity to do something locally to improve the value of our agricultural commodities.
Those are two great examples. How often do you get to a success story like that? When I think of research, I think a lot of times, you might find out science is about failure and getting slightly better than the last scientist who failed at something. This is how we progress, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than that, but...
No, it can be exactly like that,
Lori. Yeah, the scientific method is you're going to find out what doesn't work.
Well, and from an investor standpoint, a private investor standpoint, the best thing that we can do is provide a small amount of funding and kill it as fast as we possibly can, because if you can kill it, then, you know, and meaning, you know, the experiment doesn't work,
right?
Then you shouldn't continue to put private capital behind it. But you did to start, and you tried it just to see if it would work. And so long as you're doing that with the right intent, right, you're trying to solve a problem that the market has, yeah, where a customer would actually pay you money for the solution.
Sure.
As long as you start with that in mind, you're usually making good decisions. Now, not everything works, to your point, Lori. And so you kill it as fast as you can. And then the ones that continue to progress, even though it's going to be a zigzag, you pivot a number of different times, as any startup company does, usually with good people, good coachable people, things can be a success.
Go ahead, President.
Yeah, I wanted to tag on to this. One of the frustrations for a governor or a legislator is the lag time between the investment and the return on that investment. And mm-hmm. and that's real. The 2010 money that then Governor Rounds put out, you think about that, that was basically 15 years ago. And now we have two tremendous examples of the return on investment on that original money. But that takes a long time. And the legislators who passed the appropriations 15 years ago aren't here. But we thank them very much for cooperating. But the lag time is not in favor of people understanding the complexity of it. It can be frustrating, as you said, so there can be failures. So that's part of the challenge we face. There's something that's kind of, there's some brutal honesty here, though, that Medgene and HODECH are examples of success that we're really proud of, but they're unique, and there's some examples that certainly at the School of Mines have been very successful, but mm-hmm. relatively unique in South Dakota. But we are 50th in the nation in research productivity, and so it is unique, and it's unique because we've spent so little on, we've invested so little over time that these examples are infrequent, but it's because of the lack of a steady flow of resources into economic development, into research-based economic development.
So if you had an 18% increase in research expenditures from last year, are you happy with that?
We'd be thrilled. If we had a 3% increase, we'd be thrilled.
Yeah. But you're continuing to grow, is what you're saying. There needs to be more.
Right. Well, we need more on the state level. To be competitive, we need to upgrade labs. We need to keep our buildings in shape. You know, the maintenance and repair budget was cut last year for all state buildings, but it certainly hurt SDSU. You know, we've made enormous investments at the School of Mines and USD and SDSU in the research engine that we have. And so we need to take care of it, and we need to invest more, in my opinion.
Here's what should give state government and our citizens in South Dakota some reason to believe. I think President Dunn's vision that he described earlier, you know, about precision or artificial intelligence around crops and animals or rural health or bioprocessing, when you focus your vision on the areas of strength that you have, you increase your chances of success. So it's not like we're casting, you know, or using a shotgun in this broad pattern of we're going to, you know, have the next cancer drug or we're going to do this or that. It's not moonshots. These are things that South Dakota is really, really good at: bioprocessing, rural healthcare, you know, precision or artificial intelligence around crops and animals. We're really good at those things. So when you focus like that, you increase your chances of success.
Okay, but we're not really good at maternal health deserts. So from the point of rural health care, we also want to address a problem. So in one way, we want to incentivize, you know, something that we're really good at and lean into and find new solutions that maybe people haven't even thought about. We also have to say, look, we have a problem here. How do we address that? And I'm not sure anybody's going to make a lot of money off of solving the maternal health care problem.
Well,
but it's important to do.
I don't mean to be argumentative. I do think that if I'm a committed citizen in some rural communities in South Dakota, this would be very exciting for me. If I was in Gettysburg or Winter or Chamberlain or Mitchell or Aberdeen or, you name it, Yankton, for example. I mean, all of those communities would benefit from all of us figuring out how to take better care of women during the reproductive part of their life. And
right. No, I agree with that. I'm just saying I don't know that someone's going to make money off of it.
Well,
so it becomes a public good. Am I thinking about this wrong?
Well, from an employer standpoint, Lori, actually taking care of the mom that in most cases is working, there are certain productivity enhancements that come with taking care of the mom and making sure that they have, you know, the right care and the right leave. And so to the extent that work that South Dakota does on rural health and moms and in that period of time, that can lead to real dollars for employers taking care of those workers.
And you're saying we're good at that?
No, I think we need to get much better at it.
Okay. But we're good at rural health.
No, I think we need to get much better at it. Yeah, no, the challenge is that part of the out-migration from small communities is it's not just a school district. It's not just that we can't get a pastor in a church. It's also basic health care. And so as we improve basic health care in all those communities I mentioned and more, we can stabilize the rural communities, which I get, you're exactly right. It's certainly a public good, but it's also makes a ranch family more sustainable over more generations if that next generation of women on those family ranches can be healthy. And
it sounds like research worthy of funding.
It does to me. Mm-hmm. All right. What didn't I ask you that you want to make sure that you leave South Dakotans with today?
This is a frontier. This is exciting. This is I get excited about it because it is the frontier of our state. It's so whether it's making soybean meal four times the value that it is right now, or it's improving the reproductive health of young women across the state, or it's helping empower programs like. Or if it's research around Every Acre Counts and how precision agriculture not only helps agriculture but helps wildlife and other populations, I think it's exciting. It's if we look upon those things with the right positive attitude that there are solutions and we can find them and we can all benefit from them. I think it's a pretty easy sell.
That's Barry Dunn, president of South Dakota State University, and Mark Lukey, managing director and CEO of South Dakota Innovation Partners. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Phone bans in school have become a hot-button issue, but it's not quite as simple as to ban or not to ban. Our Teacher Talk educators are here to explain why. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. She has taught for more than 25 years. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. Here's our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about cell phone bans. Gina Benz, you wanted to write about this week. How come?
Because my own school district is strengthening their resolve on a cell phone ban. Mm-hmm. Yes, in our high schools, it's always been present in our elementary and middle schools. And so I know this is not just my own school district. It's many schools, many school districts. And I know it's on teachers' minds and parents' minds, everyone's minds.
And, you know, this is the Ken Burns line. It's complicated.
It is so complicated.
It's not as easy to decide what to do or to decide what works, to know what works. Mm-hmm. Right? Jackie, tell us a little bit about some of the research that's been out there about cell phone bans, the problems, the very real problems with cell phones and young people. Mm-hmm. But do bans work? What do we know and what do we not know, you guys?
Yeah, I'm actually planning to write about this more in depth, and we'll talk more next week about the in-depth research. But the first thing is that a lot of it is emerging. You know, cell phones have not been around that long, and so, like, long studies about cell phones have not been around that long, but then the policies around cell phones have been around for an even shorter period of time. And so they have not been studied as comprehensively until late. So some of the things that I've been thinking about and reading about is that not only are we looking at what works from the school district standpoint, we're looking at what parents think works, and then also what students are saying the issue is. Yeah. So there's been a lot of research about mental health and cell phones, and then now this new research is coming out about, do we need bans? What are the policies? Yeah.
How does what does a ban work? Mm-hmm. What does an effective ban look like and the implications of that? In other words, it's not as easy as saying, hey, when I was a kid, we didn't have these, because now they do exist.
Right.
And taking them away means something different for kids today than would have meant for us around this table because we didn't have that. And it's hard to come up with an equivalent of saying, oh, well, it would be like leaving this outside the classroom when we were kids, because that just wasn't really...
Different times.
It was different times, you know. And Gina, you have written really eloquently about this in the past, about why, you know, you kind of allow them, when you allow them and how you allow them. So you've thought a lot through this. But what are some of the reasons that you have found that you write on our blog at sdpb.org/teachertalk that you've observed or encountered that, you know, that people say... this is why a ban is not as effective or as easy as you think.
Yeah, and let me start with that. A lot of people say, well, just ban them.
Right.
Just ban them. That's easy. Just say no phones. It's not that easy. Here are some reasons. Parents, they want a quick and easy way to get a hold of their kids in the event of some sort of emergency. And so people often say, well, they can call the school. No, I'm saying quick and easy. In the event of an emergency.
Yeah. And I had an experience with this, too, where my daughter did not have a cell phone and there was a blizzard and I called the school and they were overwhelmed with everything that was happening in the blizzard and the message never got to her. So schools are no longer equipped to be the switchboard for parents either.
Especially large schools.
Yeah.
Parents, we now have a culture where when the three of us were growing up, you made a plan and you stuck to your plan because you couldn't get a hold of people to change plans very easily. But that's not our culture anymore. Now plans change quickly and often to make for the best experience for people. And so parents want to be able to communicate those plans quickly and easily without having a go-between that they have to trust and rely on. Students have reasons, too. They obviously want connection with their friends and with their family. But... this is a big one. They want a distraction. If they're feeling bored, uncomfortable, awkward, maybe if they are feeling like they are ill-equipped, like they're inadequate, they like to grab that phone like a security blanket and be scrolling on their phone.
Yeah, it's a comfort object.
It's a comfort object, and it makes you look like you have something to do, you are important, you have connections. There might be a moment where you feel really awkward and inadequate. And then for teachers, it's actually really hard to enforce phone bans because kids are so smart and they have such genius ways to thwart these cell phone bans, things I've never even conceived of. And so we're trying, but the kids are so smart. And then also we got a lot of battles that we're fighting in the classrooms. Maybe battles is a bad word, but there's just a lot of issues and concerns going on. And sometimes, honestly, cell phones aren't the most important of those issues. And the last thing I'll say is that phones are expensive. Parents, students, they don't want other people grabbing their phones, taking their phones, being in charge of their phones. And honestly, as
it's a security issue.
It is. And honestly, as a teacher, I don't want to be in charge of that $1,000 phone either. For a lot of families, that's a huge investment they've made.
Which is why we all have them on ourselves all the time, because we are so conditioned to not lose your phone. Of all the things that you can't lose as long as you have your phone. So, and this is what you talk really wonderfully is about the culture that we live in. And Jackie, I don't know if you found that as powerful
as I did,
but at the very end, Gina says, like, hey, we need to have this bigger cultural conversation. What if the pastor stopped the sermon every time somebody in the congregation looked at their phone? What if in a meeting? And that really resonated with me because I think of, in meetings, everybody's at a workplace. Nobody leaves their phone outside the meeting room and comes in and has a meeting.
Right.
Then if the person leading the meeting stopped every single time and said, I saw Lori looked at her phone right now. Lori, would you put your phone away? Yeah. We would never get anything done.
And it's not just that. It impedes the experience of the other people who are keeping their phones away.
Right.
But now we're punishing everybody by stopping the meeting and hurting the flow, hurting the progress of the meeting.
Yeah.
And we're also creating an environment that just creates a little bit more anxiety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But this is also the most discouraging thing about your blog post, too, is realizing just how ingrained the culture is and how I'm not looking at my phone during a meeting because I'm bored or overwhelmed or feeling awkward. I'm looking at it because the expectation is that I'm in this meeting and I am also responding to everybody who's trying to connect with me at that time. And if I don't, that people feel like they couldn't reach me.
Mm-hmm. And some would argue you're being an excellent journalist and professional by being able to both be in an in-person meeting and participate in that and keep up with your online communications at the same time. And in many people's fields, that's an expectation that you would be able to do both of those things at the same time. And so I think to the example you were giving, Gina, if we were to have a meeting, adults are having meetings, and the presenter at the meeting was stopping and calling out folks for using their phone, that person would probably roll their eyes at them, which is exactly what the children in our care do, because it feels almost silly. You know what I mean? Like when we think of it from that lens. Mm-hmm. And then it's not at all silly because we are trying to instill, we're trying to help them lengthen their ability to pay attention to one thing for an extended period of time. We're trying to help them learn how to be present with the people that are around them. We're trying to help them socially connect. We're trying to help them work through those awkward feelings that they might be having that they're reaching for their phone for. And so it's both. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all of the things that Gina wrote about in the blog. It's all of it.
Is this a big school problem?
It's an every school problem.
The superintendent of Platt Geddes talked about their phone ban, and he said it was hard at first, but now everybody's kind of, now obviously he's a superintendent. He's not a teacher in a classroom seeing the people trying to get around it on the day-to-day, but he's in communication with his teachers. So is it easier in a small school where parents might know the school secretary closer or whoever's answering the phone at school more closely? Is it easier in a small school across South Dakota?
It might be. I don't know. I want to hear from from those folks.
Mm-hmm. I'll be interested. I'm going to dig more into the research this week and kind of see if there's any trends that are coming out. But from what I've read so far, it seems like it can be complicated everywhere and that there are solutions that seem to be working in multiple places too. And so it can be as simple as we've implemented a ban. We have really good buy-in from our community members. We have really good buy-in from our teachers. We have really good buy-in from our students. And it's working. And I think that can happen or not happen in any community.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe a smaller community, it is easier because you have fewer people who need to buy in. And there's already that certain small town connection people all have. Whereas in a bigger school, it's just a more varied community of people.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, though, that we have to address it.
I agree. And so I do have, you know.
And that's what you've said here is, but I think we can't go today without saying the problem of students being in the classroom, feeling overwhelmed, awkward, slightly bored, and immediately going to this device. Like we as in culturally and as a society, we have a problem with our phones that we're not talking about. Adults, kids, little kids, toddlers.
Yeah, it's an escape, isn't it? It's a way to deal with difficult emotions that you are having yourself or you're observing your toddler having. It's a way to escape, just like it used to be to head to the bar and have a few drinks was a way to escape.
We don't know what it's doing to our attention spans. I mean, we do. There's some research about what it's doing to our attention spans, what it's doing with our ability to read. Every time I open my phone, I see an article about reading right now and what's happening in the world of books and literature and reading.
Yeah, even college professors will say to you, I just can't assign as much reading as I used to.
Yep.
And, you know, again,
Or writing.
And again, it's complicated. People can't just say, well, just assign it. And then the kids get an F, they get a D. No, because we're about learning.
Right.
And so we have to assign, we have to give the reading that supports learning for the people who are in front of us.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I had a unique experience this last year, but I did not feel that I had to shorten my reading assignments.
Oh, good.
Or cut out any writing assignments. I did feel that I had strong readers and strong writers. And also, I didn't feel that I had a particular cell phone problem in my classroom. Like, students obviously use their phones at various points, but I didn't feel like, oh, I'm teaching to a sea of students who are only on their devices and they're not seeing or hearing me at all. That was not my experience. So, but I have read what you're talking about. I mean, there's multiple articles in the Chronicle of Higher Education of professors saying of students are not reading the full length of the text. But I am very grateful that at least this last year, I didn't notice that as an issue in my classroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think a lot depends on the subject and what's being taught and how it's being taught. And I agree. I have some classrooms where it's not a problem and some where it is.
Right.
Yeah, there's factors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned here Chromebook and device usage in the school, which you say, hey, we also need to be talking about that. How much are we assigning that has to be accessed by a device? And is that the right mix? And is it for the right reasons?
I felt a little bit provocative when I wrote those words. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should use our Chromebooks less. I mean, school districts spend a lot of money for students to have these, but I don't think the school district ever intended for students to be on them as much as they are sometimes. We can use them and then we can put them away. Mm-hmm. And we should be putting them away more often, in my opinion. And I'm speaking as a person who teaches technology and education at the college level.
Right.
And I teach my future teachers, don't have this technology out all the time.
Yeah.
Well, that
was a problem for me and my daughter's been out of school for a while now, so I'm always cognizant of that. But I think we were there the first year that the Chromebooks came into the Sioux Falls School District in sixth grade. That was her first year. And I was not a fan because, you say they need to be off of them, but every assignment was in there. There was no textbook anymore. It was, they'd only have to carry this one thing. But if that Chromebook went down, and then I have to monitor in a way or pay attention in a way to make sure that was what was happening, was that the, assignment was what was going on and how long should it be on the assignment versus a textbook? Well, there is no text, everything. So if someone had 4 hours of homework, it was 4 hours of screen time.
Mm-hmm.
And that just changed. That was very difficult as an adjustment. And maybe that's changed, since.
Yeah. And so in my own classroom, to avoid constant screen time, we do a lot of discussion in partners, in small groups, as a whole group. It almost goes back to ancient times with Socrates.
Right.
We talk it through a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at home, that homework.
Well, you know me. I don't give a lot of homework.
Right. Yeah.
So we do a lot. We do our work in class, and we work hard while we're in class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This whole conversation is just, I'm thinking about other conversations I've had with folks, and when I've assigned things that are printed, people will comment, oh, you've wasted so much paper.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You just can't win for trying, you know what I mean? There's there's critiques on every side. And I think this is the whole point of the blog that Gina wrote, which is it is complicated.
It is really complicated.
And people the opinions that people hold are not just casual opinions.
Right. Yeah.
They are deep-seated. This is core to my belief. This is how I feel about technology. This is how I feel about my own childhood. This is how I feel about my kids' experience. This is how I feel about the future. This is how I feel about politics. Like, all of that seems to come into play when we talk about the cell phone.
That's today's Teacher Talk. As always, our educational guides have been Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. Benz teaches English at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls and is an adjunct education professor. And Dr. Jackie Wilbur is director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at USD's School of Education. Teacher Talk is also a podcast, so you can find it on your favorite podcast platform. Find the companion blogs at sdpb.org/teachertalk. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us here at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.